The Word of Mouth podcast is brought to you by
Dartmouth Hitchcock. Imagine nationally ranked healthcare in your community.
With convenient locations throughout northern New England,
world-class providers are closer than you think. Visit dartmouthhitchcock.org to learn more.
Dartmouth Hitchcock is here.
Word of Mouth.
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 This is Word of Mouth from NHPR. I'm Virginia Prescott. In January of 2016, the BBC experienced one of the largest and highest profile distributed denials of service, or DDoS attacks, to date. New World Hacking, the group behind the attack, promised that it would be just the beginning. DDoS attacks have since prevented access to websites for political campaigns, banks, and other financial websites, including MasterCard, Visa, and PayPal. Google Ideas and Arbor Networks have found that more than 2,000 of these attacks occur daily. For more on what DDoS means and why denial of service has become the most publicized tool for digital sabotage, well, we're turning to Rob Fleischman, principal engineer at Akamai Technologies, the group which restored service to the BBC in that 2016 attack, and our go-to tech guy. Rob, welcome.
Great to be here, Virginia.
Nice to see you. So from a user perspective, what would happen if I go to a website and there's been a DDoS attack?
Well, you'll probably have either no access to that site or really slow, terrible access to that site. You know, a broken web page where images don't load, or maybe the site just doesn't appear up at all.
So no, like, 404 message or anything like that?
No, generally you'll get nothing. Maybe your browser will time out or you'll get some other generic error message, yeah.
Yep. So did New World Hacking actually claim credit for the denial of service attack against the BBC?
Well, you know, I can't get too close to the specifics of that issue. As you know, Akamai was the company I work for was greatly involved in mitigating that. But, you know, I can tell you a little bit about how these things work so people can sort of understand what we're talking about here. So there's a lot of criminal activity on the internet, right? In recent news, we've heard a lot about hacking. Mm-hmm. And let me give you an analogy. Let's say that we pick our favorite fast food restaurant, it's owned by Virginia Prescott, Virginia's Burgers, let's call it. So, you know, if I'm a hacker, what I want to do is I want to break into Virginia's Burgers, maybe steal some of her money, maybe steal her recipes, maybe take some of her equipment. That's more like a hacking attack, right? Mm-hmm. Breaking into your facility.
Or credit card numbers of
exactly.
My customers.
You got it. I'm trying to break into your facility, take something of yours. A denial of service attack or a distributed denial of service attack is a little different. So if I do a DDoS attack on your Virginia's Burger company, what I'll do is I'll fill your parking lot full of cars. I'll fill your drive-through with thousands and thousands of cars. So that way, when legitimate customers come up to your business, they go, wow, there's no place to park. The line for the drive-through is 100 miles long. I can't get service. I can't do anything. So I'm either going to go somewhere else or just throw my hands up and be waiting for days and days and days to get service.
So a DDoS attack would be like sending a bunch of requests to download a website, so many that it just sort of overflows.
Exactly. That's exactly the analogy. And you're exactly right. There are four different flavors of DDoS attacks. You know, this connection attacks, like what you were talking about, where you have a lot of people trying to get to your website, you know, malicious people trying to download and consume your resources. You have volume attacks, where people send a lot of traffic at you. There's fragmentation attacks where they send weird traffic patterns that cause your website or your servers to do lots of work. And then there's application level things. For example, I'll give you the analogy with Virginia's Burgers. Let's say I make a whole bunch of orders that are very complicated. Virginia, here's 10,000 hamburger orders, all complicated. One without lettuce, one without mayo, one without ketchup, whatever. So that you have to do a lot of work preparing these orders. But then there's no one to actually pay at the register. Mm-hmm. So I make the order and then I leave. So now your resource has been consumed. So there are different styles of attacks, but they all have the same goal, and that is to take down your offering.
And how long does it work for? I mean, like with the BBC, how long did it take you to turn that around?
Some of these things, you know, attacks sometimes go on for days and days. You know, it really depends on who you're attacking and what kind of infrastructure they have. And let me give you an example. So today, if you want to do a distributed denial of service attack, let's say you're someone who's not so nice, you can go off and you can rent lots of servers. So, you know, maybe about $150 a day to rent a bunch of compromised machines, people's home PCs or internet cameras or other types of equipment that has been infected with viruses and malware. So I can go out and I can pay $150 to someone, usually a nefarious person, who will then rent me the use of their network of bad machines. So I can use those bad machines to direct traffic at someone I want to attack. On the reverse side of that, even at the low end, to defend against denial of service attacks, there are companies that do it for, you know, $1,000 a month or so. So just buying the insurance policy and the protection against denial of service attacks is not free. You know, $1,000 a month, even for very, very low attack mitigation, is pretty expensive. Now, if you're a large company, you know, a financial services organization, you know, you're going to want to pay much more money for much more sophisticated defenses. That's really where my company comes in. We protect people like the Fortune 500, the Fortune 1000, you know, very, very high profile.
Right. So people who are making a lot of money online, tons of transactions.
Exactly. So, like anything, there's a hierarchy of attackers and there's a hierarchy of defenders. Mm-hmm. But again, the people who really suffer are the small sites. You know, if you have a small company and you have a small website and you get a denial of service attack on you, you know, you're going to have to come out of your wallet for that. And that's really sad.
Okay. So as always, you've opened up a bunch of different stuff. One is, I want to go back to that sort of
sure.
like you can hire these servers.
Sure.
So there are people who will go do contract like hits,
you got it.
Lack of a better word.
You got it. And the motivation is really, I see, you know, three or four motivations. Of course, one is ransom. You know, hey, Virginia, I'm going to take your website down, or it is down, and until you pay me. The second one is political. You know, maybe you.
Right,
I don't,
the Trump campaign got
absolutely.
The details.
I don't like whatever you're saying or whatever you're selling or the part of the world you're from or who your owners are or for whatever reason. So I have a political difference with you. The next one is revenge. Perhaps you've done something bad to me and I want to take down your site or company. I'm an
I'll
ex-employee.
Never do that,
something
Rob.
Like that. There's also interesting things like gamers do this a bit. For example, you know, I want an advantage in a particular game or a particular gambling site or something like that. So I'll attack certain parts of the network that my opponents are using. And therefore, my part of the network runs quickly and theirs runs slowly. And then finally, there's, you know, I hate to use this term because it's so loaded, but cyber warfare. You know, the idea of countries attacking other countries. And DDoS attacks are also sometimes a part of larger cyber warfare. For example, let's say I'm trying to hack into your a part of your network. I might launch a DDoS attack on another part of your network to put your security resources over there so that way I go unnoticed in other parts. Or I use the huge volume of a DDoS attack to hide the hacking that I'm doing.
We're talking about denial of service or DDoS attacks with Rob Fleischman. He's explaining how, in some cases, why they happen, where websites will be shut down by an overload of requests and basically become rendered dysfunctional. Well, okay, so what is the difference, though, you know, in this DDoS strike and hacking, you know, like embarrassing internal Democratic emails, right, posted on WikiLeaks, hacks for which, by the way, the U.S. government has formally accused Russia of doing?
Well, I think the big difference, again, is what you're after. So a denial of service attack, whether it's distributed or just a regular denial of service attack, are about making it so your attack, the victim of your attack can't service anyone.
Right. You're overloaded.
They're overloaded. They can't service good customers, bad customers. They can't do anything. They might as well not be online.
Mm-hmm.
A hacking attack is really about breaking an entry. I want to go into a site. I want to get information from them for whatever particular reason, extract it, and do what I want with
it. Right. They get my secret sauce burger recipe.
Absolutely.
Okay,
absolutely.
But how about protecting against them? Because, you know, I do want to mention a spokesman for Vladimir Putin says this is absolute nonsense. You know, Vladimir Putin's website gets attacked several tens of thousands of times a day, right? But that's the question. This big hack happened against the BBC in January. Have people like you, you know, like Akamai and your kind of security companies gotten mm-hmm. ahead of it? Are they just still ahead of us or are there ways that you can protect yourself against it?
Okay, so it really depends on who you are. You know, if you are MasterCard and Visa or companies like that, Fortune 500 companies, there's a lot of resources available for you. These resources are not free. This is expensive stuff. This is resource intensive stuff. This is state-of-the-art technology. And that stuff is available, absolutely. As you go down the tree and you're a smaller and smaller company, there's still stuff available at lower prices, but it's not nearly as good. You know, are you going to be able, as Virginia's Burger Shop, to defend against a denial of service attack from the Chinese government? Unlikely. Unlikely you will. And neither will the provider who provides the infrastructure for your website be able to. So that's the unfortunate thing. The folks who are small, who are attacked by those who are large, that's going to be a problem.
Is there a reason that these are more commonplace today, you know, maybe, or we're hearing about them now? Is it easy to do?
The reason why it's more commonplace is a product of the number of things that are connected to the internet, right? So 10 years ago, there weren't nearly as many devices online, right? Not everyone had high-speed internet. So now that everyone has high-speed internet, you combine that with a lot of people are not very technology savvy. I spoke previously about why your internet is slow. A lot of people have devices that are old or unpatched or not up to date, or maybe they can't afford to buy newer devices, right? So those devices are frequently hackable, are frequently infected with malware, are frequently under the control of someone else, and you don't even know that. So there's a lot of real estate out there for bad guys to take over. And once they take over and control that real estate, then they can use that as part of a denial of service attack. The word that folks use is they call it botnets or botnet armies. The idea that I control as a bad person, hundreds or thousands of machines or devices that are not mine, that are on the internet, that I have surreptitiously made, surreptitiously control, and allow them to do attacks on my behalf. And that's really why these type of attacks have gotten popular. Those networks of botnets, those networks of infected machines are much easier to build and therefore easier to sell access to.
All right. So do you think that this is always going to be a kind of tactic that's used online?
I think so. I think it's part of the standard toolkit for malware now. I think it'll ebb and flow. I think as devices get older and get replaced and security technology gets better, these things will be harder and harder. But, you know, it's an arms race, right? I mean, this is what's really hot right now. In a few years, there'll be something else, and this won't be as popular. But I think it'll always be part of the toolkit for malware and attacks.
Rob Fleischman, he is principal engineer at Akamai Technologies and our resident tech explainer here with the download on DDoS attacks. Rob, thank you so much for speaking with us.
Always great to be here, Virginia. Thanks for having me.
Thank you. This is Word of Mouth from NHPR. I'm Virginia Prescott. Hackers are a part of San Francisco's new tech economy. And as more Silicon Valley workers and tech money move in, longtime residents are being priced out. Homelessness is on the rise, becoming a challenge for the city and for its hackers. Holly McDee checked in with One Hackerspace to find out how they're helping.
The Noisebridge Hackerspace, located on Mission and 18th Street, looks like a garage workshop scaled up to 5,200 square feet. There's sewing kits, a laser printer, a dark room, a kitchen, and a wood shop. And off in the corner, by the 3D printers and electroencephalogram, there's Chris Zapata's sort of bed.
There's a hacker stacker with three spots, and the hacker stacker is like three just basic pods with a yoga mat and stairs for the top two levels.
It's 1 a.m. or so on a Monday morning, and Zapata is showing me around.
Can I say the disclaimer where I don't feel like I represent the space?
Yeah.
Okay. Disclaimer. I am not a member of, or have ever been a member of, the hackerspace known as Noisebridge.
This is a crucial distinction. Members make the rules at Noisebridge. They pay dues to cover the building's rent, and they decide who can use the space.
Rule number one is, be excellent. Rule number two, I guess, is if you don't know anything, ask someone. And rule number three is, I don't know rule number three, actually. I think those are just two rules.
Zapata's still learning how Noisebridge works. He's attracted to the hacker ethos of duocracy, that action of any kind is valued and rewarded. But he's got more pressing reasons to stay at Noisebridge. He's homeless, and the mission is dangerous at night.
In my sense, in my case, it's partially a choice, I guess, to squat here or to leave to nap here sometimes.
Since Noisebridge moved to this location in 2008, there's been constant debate about people like Zapata, whether they're hackers or just crashers.
And so what we say to people is, yeah, you know, you come here to hack, but like, what does hack mean?
Danny O'Brien is one of 100 or so members of the collective. About 900 other people also use the space each month. O'Brien says those people do a lot of things that technically qualify as hacking.
You know, trying to break into computers recreationally, but it also means like doing stuff in the woodshop, and it also means like playing pranks on people. And you can always kind of defend yourself by going, no, I'm just hacking this sandwich, or, you know, I'm hacking my sleep patterns or something.
It's a safe place. It's a good place. I like it.
Mark O'Neill was sleeping at Noisebridge until about a month ago when he was banned. The charge was lack of hacking, or more specifically, repeated drunken behavior, including spreading cheesecake over his face and taking his pants off in what he called an art experiment. Yet O'Neill insists that he's contributed.
I'm always working. I don't need much sleep. A bit scattered, sorry. I've been up for a while working in the new machine shop.
What class do you teach?
How to make anything. Industrial design. How to make anything out of anything.
O'Neill disagrees with the ban, but he doesn't get a say. Only members are allowed to block votes. And member Paul Manon says banning people is the only way to maintain an inclusive environment.
While the regular people won't come here, a lot of women, a lot of kids who won't come here because they perceive they do not have access to a safe environment.
Manon says someone like O'Neill is a nuisance, but they've had to confront more serious problems. Things like thievery, assaults, drug abuse, and property damage. So they try to enforce the rules consistently, and that sometimes means kicking people out.
For instance, this morning, I happened to come to Noisebridge at 5 a.m. Just to drop off something, and I found 8 people sleeping here. Maybe 3 of them were actually, you know, some of the usual hackers around here. The rest of them look like street people that just kind of dropped in.
Danny O'Brien acknowledges that the line between napping and sleeping can be blurry, and that it can stand in for that bigger question of who's a hacker at all.
So with 1,000 people, it's really possible to walk in and not know anyone else. And so I think that what that means is if somebody is like, you know, laid out on the sofa, like, do you go and wake them up and go, no, you must be hacking? It's awkward.
I'm trying to do is basically like, I have 3 LEDs and I want to have one control line that controls all of them. So like 1 volt turns 1 on, 2 volts.
During the day, Noisebridge is a nerd haven. You can't walk in without someone asking you what you hack. There's circuit hacking classes, Python classes, a Dream Team brain hacking class, and a 3D game development group. That's just on an average day. At night, people still work intently. Every sound seems to echo, as though Noisebridge were a cave. The night I met Chris Zapata, I tried sleeping at Noisebridge. Over in the kitchen, one hacker was making a smoothie, nodding distractedly as Mark O'Neill blissfully reported his day's adventures. Zapata searched through the refrigerator and grabbed some cherries. I didn't see a Noisebridge member anywhere, and every soft surface was occupied. Around 5 a.m., I scored a hacker stacker. There was a dog above me that wouldn't stop growling. The man sleeping above him was snoring. And by that time, Mark O'Neill was drunk and loud. There was no way I was getting to sleep.
Live! Live!
Danny O'Brien says most members don't think Noisebridge should have to deal with these kinds of problems, and adds that they already offer a lot to help the homeless. Anyone can subscribe to the Noisebridge jobs page. You can take a class on programming. You can use a computer. And the Noisebridge wiki page offers links to sources of food, shelter, storage, and showers.
If anyone can come up with like a solution for homelessness that involves writing some programs in C or an iPod app, then by all means email us and let us know, because we'd be right on it.
Chris Zapata knows his days at Noisebridge might be numbered.
If it comes down to that, then I wouldn't mind presenting myself to the community, because I feel that at least the way I used it and the way I've napped here is I've tried to be the least offensive, you could say, least offensive napping, and I don't think I snore, or I try not to smell so much.
Zapata slept in shelters before, but he was only able to get a bed twice. The other times, he had to sleep on a chair, clinging tightly to his belongings. Plus, at shelters, he's always had to be out by 5 a.m., so he says he's grateful for Noisebridge, and he tries to respect the rules.
Even if you can't exactly utilize the space as it was meant to be, that there's always still that possibility, like, it'll rub off on you eventually. And the people and the skills and the minds and the openness will rub off on you, and you will learn something to work with your hands and to work with your mind.
The hackers of Noisebridge may know how to build robots, print whistles from 3D printers, and read brainwaves. But homelessness remains a problem they haven't solved.
And that story was produced by Holly McDeed for Cross Currents.
Word of mouth.
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 Word of
mouth. This is Word of Mouth from NHPR. I'm Virginia Prescott. In June, Franklin Pierce University earned a prestigious honor. It became the first university in New Hampshire to receive a Big Read grant from the National Endowment of the Arts, just one of 77 organizations across the country to be awarded one. They'll be using the grant to illuminate the life and work of novelist Willa Cather, who, although her books are set on the plains of Nebraska, spent a great deal of time living and writing in the Monadnock region. The university is hosting a Willa Cather Walk on October the 21st at her writing retreat in Jaffrey, with a dramatic reading on Saturday the 22nd. And here to tell us more is Donna Decker, professor of English at Franklin Pierce University. She also heads up the Women in Leadership program there. Donna, welcome to Word of Mouth.
Thank you, Virginia. So happy to be here.
And Dr. Andrew Jewell is with us. He's a professor of digital projects at Cather's alma mater. That's the University of Nebraska at Lincoln. He's also editor of the Willa Cather Archive and co-editor of the book, The Selected Letters of Willa Cather. Andrew, welcome.
Thank you so much for having me.
Well, Donna, let's begin here. Tell us a little bit about the aim of the Big Read grant and why Franklin Pierce chose to focus on Willa Cather.
Well, there was no question it was Willa Cather all the way. While Willa Cather spent her early years in Virginia and Nebraska, she spends eternity with us in Jaffrey. She's buried there. And she wrote, among her other fabulous works, My Antonia, which is uncannily contemporary. This is a book that takes up the topics of, you know, the topics that are in the news today, immigration, how difficult it is if one comes to this country and doesn't speak English. It talks about sexual assault. It talks about women's sexuality. It talks about suicide, identity. It could not be a more fitting book. And so the goal of the Big Read is to nurture and promote literature. It's the largest reading program in American history. And what it does is allows a space, a shared space, for listening not only to people's thoughts about a book, but to extend conversations that would connect community members.
Is this the program that has people read one book or one author simultaneously?
It is. There are others like it, but this is the biggest one, is the NEA Big Read. Yes, one book. So our focus is completely on Willa Cather and My Antonia.
Andrew, as a scholar of Willa Cather, what did you see? What was her relationship to New Hampshire?
She first went there in 1917 at the invitation of friends and stayed at the Shattuck Inn in Jaffrey and connected with it deeply, would go across the way and write in a meadow near the Shattuck Inn, and that's where My Antonia came to life. That's where it emerged in part. And then she kept coming back year after year to the Shattuck Inn, loved it, spent many of her autumns there throughout her adult life, and said the best parts of all my best books was written here. And so that's, I think, one reason that attachment she had is why she chose to be buried in the old burying ground in Jaffrey.
It's so funny, though, because she's conjuring up the plains of Nebraska, and she's overlooking Mount Monadnock.
Right. And I think she wanted the distance from her memories of the place, and that helped her reflect on them and then shape them into art.
Is New Hampshire ever actually reflected in her writing, specifically writing about being there?
Well, only in her letters, over and over in her letters. But in her fiction, I don't believe there is a direct depiction of the Monadnock region.
So when was it mentioned and how in her letters?
Many times she writes from the Shattuckin to friends and family about her experiences writing there. She will go into detail in some letters about her memories writing that place, about the privacy and the silence and the weather and the natural world that she experiences there. She exchanged letters with the owners of the Shattuck Inn. She wrote the only surviving letter to her partner, Edith Lewis, is from the Shattuck Inn and really reflects on how at home she feels in that space. So you can feel her attachment to Jaffrey and the whole area in her letters.
Donna, can you give us a sense of what her life was like, a typical day in living and writing as Willa Cather in New Hampshire?
Well, I can tell you this, and this connects to what you were saying in the beginning. We're going to be doing a Willa Cather tour on the 21st, Friday the 21st. And one of the things we're going to do is replicate the walk that she took. So when she stayed, as Andy said, in the summers at the Shattuck, she would walk from the Shattuck up what we're calling now the Willa Cather Walk. It's up a very beautiful wooded lane up to this meadow, grassy meadow area. And there was a tent pitched, and she would write. She would go up there for about 2 hours each day and do her writing there and then walk back to the inn. And so we're going to, on the 21st, as one of our many big read events, we're going to actually do that walk and then make our way to her graveside, which is in the old burying ground in Jaffrey. And there we're going to have a candlelight graveside reading with a host, with Marlon Fitzwater as our host, because he is a super fan of Willa Cather.
What a beautiful late fall evening thing to do. Sounds great.
It is, yeah.
Well, Andrew, you mentioned the letters, and when Cather died in 1947, she did leave a will explicitly forbidding the publication of her personal letters. Why was she so adamant about her letters not being seen?
There are a couple of different explanations and theories. She didn't leave an explicit explanation for this choice, but she did want the audience to know her through the fiction and the published work she had really struggled over and refined and taken great pains with, and I think was less comfortable with having an audience know her through quick letters dashed off to friends and family from her teenage years. And we can understand that. I think it was quite good that for many decades, her first two executors did preserve that ban and make sure those letters were not published and respected her wishes. But over these decades, she became part of the shared cultural heritage. And scholars continually wrote biographies or made documentary films or wrote articles about her works that were impoverished because of this lack of access to her letters. And so when it became legally possible in 2011 to publish her letters, it seemed to us like exactly the thing that needed to happen, the right thing to do to make the scholarship better and more accurate.
We're talking about Willa Cather, the author of My Antonia and other classics of fiction, lived and worked and wrote in New Hampshire for a long time. Franklin Pierce University is hosting a walk for Willa Cather next week. I'm speaking with Donna Decker from the university and also Andrew Jewell, who is a professor at Cather's alma mater, the University of Nebraska at Lincoln. Did it not feel at all to you, though, as a scholar, that you were defying her?
I knew I was defying what she wanted at one point in her life, but my obligation is not to the dead, but to the living, really. And I feel like there's a poet when he dedicated a historical property that's about Cather in Nebraska. John Neidhart was his name. I'm paraphrasing, but he said, we don't dedicate these memorials for the dead. We do it for the living who will continue to have their lives enriched. We can't do anything for the dead, but the living, we have a shared heritage that is ours through her. And I think it's in that spirit that I felt like this wonderful work that's in her letters, these insights, this humor, this affection, this personality, it's something that makes the world richer and needs to be out there.
Well, Donna, you were mentioning how very contemporary My Antonia reads today. But to somebody who's never read Willa Cather, knows nothing about Willa Cather, what can you tell us about her for contemporary readers who want an introduction?
Oh, I can tell you that she was inducted in 1986 into the National Cowgirl Hall of Fame.
Okay, thumbs up on that.
That alone, I should tell you. I mean, I think in some ways, my experience of her has been that what I read in her novels seems, in many ways, distinctly different from the way I read her in the letters. Now, of course, that, you know, in a literary sense, that, you know, it's not her speaking; it's a narrator. But I find her books to be a little bit more reticent than the her I know from the letters, where she's, you know, as Andy described, she's full on engaged in life and excited about life. And I don't mean to say that her novels are not that. I feel a distinction, but this novel in particular is about, it's narrated by Jim Burden, who just has this incredible affection, devotion to Antonia, who is an immigrant from Czechoslovakia, and has a really, really challenging and difficult life, and yet endures.
Anything you want to add to that, Andrew?
You know, the novel, if the readers who respond to this novel, it's distinctive in my experience in how personal people feel about it. Catherine reflects this in her own letters when shortly after the book came out, the kind of things she was hearing from readers. She said they didn't just like it, they really love it. And that's, I've met so many people from professional literary scholars to just average readers who have a real attachment to the book. Late in the novel, Antonia says to Jim, "Oh, Jim, isn't it great how much people can mean to each other?" And that's a simple statement in one sense, but it is deeply profound, too, and how the novel communicates that attachment we have to friends, to people we love in different kinds of ways from our youth and from our adult life. And I think there's this such emotional resonance in the book that people love it, and it means a lot to them.
Well, Andrew Jewell, Donna Decker, thank you so much for speaking with us.
Thank you, Virginia.
Franklin Pierce University will be hosting a Willa Cather Walk in Jaffrey on October 21st with events throughout the week, and there's more information at wordofmouthradio.org. This is Word of Mouth from NHPR. I'm Virginia Prescott. Just before the break, we were talking about Willa Cather, the author of books like My Antonia and O Pioneers, and her surprising connection to New Hampshire. Now, as part of NHPR's series The Bookshelf with Peter Biello, we're going to hear about another author with a New Hampshire connection, Allegra Hyde.
Dystopian fiction has carved out a special place in the literary canon. When we think of it, we think of Aldous Huxley's Brave New World, or George Orwell's 1984, or Margaret Atwood's The Handmaid's Tale, as prime examples of fiction that describes a world gone mad. New Hampshire author Allegra Hyde is writing of worlds transformed in a different way, but in a way that is no less terrifying. Utopian societies, where life is supposed to be perfect, but is often not. The collection of stories is called Of This New World, and it's the winner of the John Simmons Short Fiction Award from University of Iowa Press. Allegra Hyde joins me now to talk about the book. Welcome to the program.
Thank you.
What inspired you to write a variety of stories on various types of utopian societies?
I guess you could say the book is about utopianism. I've probably been fascinated by utopianism for the better part of my adult life, the past decade. And what draws me to utopias would be the conflict between idealism and practicality, especially when there are groups of people who step outside of conventional norms, social norms, to try to live differently, live out what they see as an ideal society. And I'm drawn to the bravery of those people, the courage it would take to step away, but also often the humor of those endeavors, because the fact that they are living differently often means that they're living in a way that doesn't quite work. So I enjoy the silliness that can emerge from those endeavors.
Yeah, you mentioned bravery, and I almost thought of narcissism in a way, because these people are so convinced that my way is the way, and I will show the rest of the world by getting a bunch of other people to live my way. And that's, in my opinion, where most of the humor comes from, because these people are inevitably, or to some degree, wrong.
Yeah, that makes perfect sense, that your ego is going to cause you to overlook certain things.
I had another idea about these stories that I wanted to run by you. Tell me if it doesn't quite jive with what you were going for. But it almost seemed to me that these stories were as much about utopia as they are about class difference and upward mobility, because the people who were able to seclude themselves in these closed communities often felt a little bit of guilt about those they left behind or the people who were not well off enough to join these communities. Is that something that you considered while writing these?
I don't think while I was writing it, it was directly on my mind, but in retrospect, that infuses a lot of the stories, especially a story like shark fishing, for instance, where there's a group of militant environmentalists who are really committed to saving the world, and the story is set in the Bahamas. They're working to protect the natural resources, which all seems great, except that comes into conflict with the local people who are just trying to get by, trying to feed their families. And you come up against these questions of, should a starving man be allowed to eat an endangered fish? I don't know. So I'm interested in kind of exploring those questions, and I think that does have a lot to do with class.
Mm-hmm. Especially in that story where the people who were invited to sort of learn along with the so-called experts were children of wealthy people who could afford to go and who were presumed to be most likely to have political influence later in life.
Yeah, it's a tough question when it comes to lofty ideals like an environmentally sustainable society. Who gets to be included in that society? I think Toni Morrison has a quote that's something along the lines of utopias are often thought of by the people, or imagined by the people who are not in them. And I guess when it comes to that particular story, depending on who you are, your utopia is going to be different.
You spent some time in environments similar to some of the ones in here. Could you tell us about your personal experience with these so-called utopias?
Yeah. Because I've been fascinated by utopian experiments for so long, it was kind of inevitable that I would try to visit some, experience some. So among the places I've visited, I visited what remains of Shaker communities. I backpacked through New Zealand for 5 months, visiting hippie communes, trying to see what they were up to, their efforts to live off the land. I lived in the Bahamas for a while at a eco community that was in many ways similar to the one that is in shark fishing. And it's always really inspiring in many ways to see how people are trying to live differently. But then it's also interesting to see what sorts of practical problems they run into in the ways that they're living.
Do you have a favorite short story in this collection?
I think I feel pretty strongly about Bury Me, which is a story told by a botanist or someone who's working with plants. And she goes to a friend's mother's funeral. And I guess the story for me was able to combine elements of science and emotion in a way that for me felt really rich. And it also was able to explore utopianism in a different way. And this, instead of thinking about maybe a group of a hippie commune or a group of Shakers, maybe a kind of utopia between two people, a relationship as a kind of utopia. In this case, the friendship between two young women. So that story, I think, really captured a lot of ideas that I was excited to explore in my writing.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, what I loved about that story was how the descriptions of nature, of plants, a tree, that a description of a tree was used to illuminate how this main character felt whole and where this friendship fell in her life. And the analogy I loved was when she described this tree having to get rid of needles or branches so that the whole would survive. And that seemed so perfectly analogous to that relationship that in order for her to have good mental health, she just needed to call this relationship over, even though it was good while it lasted. I just thought that was beautifully done.
Thank you.
That's not so much a question, just a, there you go, there's a compliment.
I'll take it.
So who are your influences as a writer?
Well, I think as a short story writer, I am kind of inevitably influenced by Claire Bay Watkins, who a lot of writers in my generation have read. And her collection, Battleborn, does such a tremendous job weaving together place, history, just human experience, that I really look up to her ability as a fiction writer. I also have really learned a lot from Jim Shepherd, and I admire the way he takes these sort of esoteric details, weaves them into his writing, makes them come alive, and that he also brings humor into his writing, which is something I aspire to do in my book.
What do you think are the qualities that define a good short story?
I think a good short story is a story that stays with you. You remember it. And often you remember it because it illuminates some aspect of the human experience that you hadn't fully thought about before. And I think often short stories also work well when they aren't fully resolved and you carry that story with you because you're still thinking about it. You're trying to resolve whatever that story brought up. But I think stories are fundamentally mysterious in many ways, and it's hard to pinpoint why certain stories stick with us. Sometimes I'll read a piece and I won't think that I like it, but I'll continue to ponder that story long after I've read it, and I can't quite put my finger on why or how the author really reached out and grabbed me. So stories are mysterious things, I think, at the end of the day.
Well, Allegra, thank you very much for coming in and speaking about your book, and congratulations on the award.
Thank you so much.
That's Allegra Hyde. She's the author of the new collection of short stories, Of This New World, which is the winner of the John Simmons Short Fiction Award from University of Iowa Press. And you can find a list of the top 5 books on Allegra's bookshelf at nhpr.org.
Tomorrow, we're going to be talking with the singer, songwriter, musician, and novelist Josh Ritter. He was in New Hampshire last week for a show at the Capital Center for the Arts on the day of the announcement that Bob Dylan would be awarded the Nobel Prize for Literature. So it was the day to talk to Ritter, named one of the 100 greatest living songwriters by Paste Magazine, to talk about his creative process for the 10-Minute Writer's Workshop. Ritter's songs draw deeply from traditional narrative folk music, but also from growing up in a traditional Midwestern family. Here's just a preview.
I was raised in a fairly religious home, and those stories kind of, in some cases, you go to Sunday school and they're drilled into you. But as time has gone by, I've found that I speak in that vocabulary, but that it's also useful because, biblical stories and are kind of cultural currency. They're a way to tell a larger story in a short amount of time. People can talk about the overturning the tables in the temple, and that leads you to a whole story, a whole bunch of metaphors that can come out of that. It's really rich ground for that.
Josh Ritter, who describes his most recent album, Sermon on the Rocks, as messianic, oracular honky-tonk. We figure whether it's making art or making dinner or making money, the creative people figure out how to follow an idea from their hunch to their fruition. So the 10-Minute Writers Workshop talks to all kinds of writers about that process, whether it's Josh Ritter or Supreme Court Justice Stephen Breyer talking about the strategic value of a well-written Supreme Court opinion. So it's not just for novelists or short story writers. You can subscribe to the 10-Minute Writers Workshop podcast on iTunes or Google Play. Thanks so much for your listening time today. Music in this episode came to us from Poddington Bear, Persona La Ave, Tyler Gibbons, and La Venganza de Chitara. I'm Virginia Prescott. We'll all be back tomorrow with more Word of Mouth at 2 here on NHPR.
Word of Mouth is produced by Molly Donahue, Logan Shannon,
and Jimmy Gutierrez.
Our senior producer is
Taylor Quimby,
and our executive producer is Maureen McMurray.
The views expressed in this program are those of the individuals
and not those of NHPR,
its Board of Trustees,
or its underwriters. Word of Mouth is a production
of New Hampshire Public Radio. Not a